from deep inside your audio device of choice.
Ladies and gentlemen, I believe on last week's broadcast here, I had already speculated on the possibility that in the wake of the Los Angeles firestorms, there might have been, or might still be, an emergency meeting of the International Olympic Committee, you know, somewhere in Switzerland, safe, cold, to discuss the apparent absurdity of holding the 2028 Olympics in a city that had just been so recently devastated. In the week in between then and now, officials of the Olympic Committee issued a statement expressing their assurance that the Olympics would be held in Los Angeles in 2028, the surest yet signal that they won't. Some local officials are, making a brave face of it. You know, saying how much economic good it will be doing for Los Angeles to spend $6 million holding an Olympics in a city that's been devastated. A city that was supposed to be building a lot of new rapid transit to make it, in the words of the L.A. mayor, a car-free Olympics. It doesn't mean free cars, although that will be just about as likely. Now comes this from Fast Company, the massive organizational infrastructure and transportation challenges of holding the Olympic Games is truly a marathon, and that long logistical race just became significantly harder. Transportation logistics have already become issues, with the city's expansive vision for expanding its mass transit network by 2028 becoming narrower due to funding shortfalls and missed deadlines. As somebody who's been running a newsletter covering the 28 Olympics in depth, Alyssa Walker, reported for months, that's not the only way the city has fallen behind. LA's Olympic and Paralympic committees, well, it's one committee, hasn't met since June. The city hasn't approved the final venue plan. She also notes that past games have looked at backup locations when logistics became more challenging. Increased costs are predicted for LA 28, nearly $7 billion. That's a cost, including insurance hikes and added expenses for fire prevention and readiness, which will be a key focus in the run-up to the event. The event will be happening during the traditional fire season, not the new one we had last week. Just about every modern Olympic, says Fast Company, has had cost overruns. An Oxford study found every single one underestimated final costs. The city isn't paying for the games, per se, but Los Angeles is on the hook for the first $270 million of overruns. I got that on me. Organizers have billed the 2028 Olympics as the no-build games, playing up the fact that due to the region's wealth of venues and previous experience with the Olympics, doesn't need to be constructing any new stadiums or sites. Even without that, there are still substantial construction and preparation needs in terms of infrastructure and preparing the Olympic Village at UCLA. City of LA also voted last summer to invest $54 million in upgrading its convention center before the games. Well, you got to have that. You got to have a convention center for the Olympics. All these projects will require construction workers who will be in short supply due to the efforts to rebuild. According to the president of the local chapter of Associated Builders and Contractors, the construction industry was already nervous about the scale of infrastructure and transportation work needed for LA 28. The city has been racing to upgrade its transit networks. Yeah, if you squint, you can see them. In time to handle millions of visitors and competitors who need to traverse the sprawling metro. Now the same people needed for that work will also be sought to help prepare infrastructure and rebuild homes. There's still many years before the Olympics kick off. Just as the city enters crunch time, fire recovery has made the preparation a lot more complicated. And this I didn't know until just today. LA's going to be hosting the Super Bowl in a couple of years. Sure, it can all happen. and there can be world peace. Hello, welcome to the show.
When the bells are ring and the horns are blow and the couples we know are fondly kissing, will I be with you or will I be amongst the missing? It's much too early in the game. Ah, but I thought I'd ask you just the same. What are you doing, New Year's? Arms will hold you good and tight when it's exactly 12 o'clock at night. We're coming in the new year, New Year's Eve. Maybe I'm crazy too. Suppose I'd ever be the one you chose out of the thousand invitations you received. But in case I stand one little chance, here comes the jackpot question in advance. What are you doing, New Year's? New Year's Eve. One little chance. Here comes the jackpot question in advance. What are you doing, New Year's? New Year's Eve. What are you doing, New?
From New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome you to this edition of the show. This just in, if in is where it belongs, President-elect Trump is pledging his full support for the 2028 Olympic Games in L.A., telling organizers in a meeting this week he wants to help the area recover. These are America's Olympics, Trump told Casey Wasserman, the president and chairman of the L.A. Olympic Committee. Not Mexico's Olympics, I guess. These are more important than ever to L.A., and I'm going to be supportive in every way possible to make them the greatest games, unquote. And that you can take to the bank. Unfortunately, it's a riverbank. And now...
Looks like must close.
Days after the U.S.'s Office of Defects investigation... I had no idea we had that. Began an investigation into Tesla's actually smart summon technology. We talked about on this program a week or so ago. Tesla is now recalling almost 250,000 vehicles over a separate issue, glitches with rear-view cameras on some models. Just 239,000 Teslas are affected from the 23-24 ranges. The problem is the computer circuit board might short, resulting in the vehicle losing access to the rear-view camera image. From November 21st last year, Tesla noted an increase in car computer replacements due to a power shorting malfunction, tracing the problem to software releases, which when combined with certain hardware configurations and colder temperatures, they could never happen, could increase reverse current and short the power components. The view from the rear camera would cease to be displayed. Tesla's already been rolling out an over-the-air update to fix the technical troubles, and the vehicles that have experienced the shorting condition will be able to get their car computer replaced free of charge. As of December, Tesla had identified 887 warranty claims and 68 field reports related to the condition. It said it is also not aware of any collisions, injuries, or fatalities related to the problem. That's the good news. The founder of the Dawn Project said, this is just the second time in 1 week that NHTSA has taken action against Tesla over its faulty software, highlighting the myriad safety-critical defects in Tesla systems. If Tesla cannot be trusted to develop reliable software to ensure that its rear cameras do not fail to display an image, how can it be trusted to develop an entirely autonomous driving system which doesn't require supervision? He asks. That's Dan O'Dowd of the Dawn Project. Tesla's not the only car maker suffering from software-related rear-view camera woes. 2025 also began with a recall of vehicles from Aston Martin over the view from its rear-view cameras. Yes, the three-word advice is, don't look back.
AI to the rescue, smarter every day. From work to play, it leads the way. Innovation, creation, it's here to stay. AI makes life better. Hip hip hooray.
Hey, Ralph, you want to recall that hip hip hooray for a little period of time? Apple's recent stab at AI, Apple Intelligence, has largely been disappointing, according to futurism.com. In particular, its news summaries, those aren't important, face such widespread criticism for botching headlines and reporting false information. This week, Apple paused the entire program until it could be fixed. This just out. None of this should be surprising. Such AI hallucinations are a problem inherent to all large language models. Nobody solved that problem yet, if it's even solvable at all. But releasing its own AI model sounded especially reckless when you consider that Apple engineers warned in advance about the tech's gaping deficiencies. That warning came in a study released last October, the yet-to-be peer-reviewed work, which tested the mathematical, quote, reasoning, unquote, of some of the industry's top large language models, added to the consensus that AI models don't actually reason. Who's been telling you this? Gary Marcus. Instead, the researchers concluded they attempt to replicate the reasoning steps observed in their training data. Unquote. To test the AI models, the researchers had them attempt thousands of math problems from the widely used benchmark GSM 8K dataset. A typical question is as follows. James buys 5 packs of beef that are 4 pounds each. The price of beef is $5.50 per pound. How much did he pay? Some questions are a bit more complicated. Nothing that a well-educated middle schooler can't solve. The way the researchers exposed those gaps in the AI models was shockingly easy. They simply change the numbers in the questions. This prevents data contamination, in other words, ensuring the AIs haven't seen any of these exact problems before in the training data, without actually making the problems any harder. This alone caused a minor but notable drop in accuracy in every single one of the 20 tested large language models. But when the researchers took things a bit further by also changing the names and adding in irrelevant details, like a question about counting fruits, remarking that a handful of them were, quote, smaller than usual, unquote, the performance drop was, in the researchers' own wording, quote, catastrophic, unquote, as high as 65%. Not even Ralph has a comment. These varied between models, but even the cleverest of the bunch, OpenAI's O1 preview, plummeted by 17.5%. Its predecessor, GPT-4, fell by 32%. And so concludes Futurism.com. The takeaway is harsh. How many graves is Steve Jobs spinning in right now, ladies and gentlemen? And while we're on the subject of a smart world, General Motors this week said it has reached a settlement with the FTC to address privacy concerns about their now discontinued smart driver program. Not even a real smart driver program or an improved smart driver program. They didn't even bother with those. Those concerns articulated in the U.S. watchdog's formal legal complaint against the carmaker are that GM collected precise geolocation data from millions of Generation 10 plus OnStar vehicles through a particular task that collected and transmitted precise geolocation data every 3 seconds, is all. OnStar, you know, is GM's in-car communication service. It is sold to drivers for security, emergency services, navigation, and your remote diagnostics. But according to the FTC, GM launched a program called OnStar Smart Driver 9 years ago, subsequently struck deals with telematics analysis firms to provide these businesses with driver data, like yours, like mine, except not mine. The program allegedly provided driver behavior data at least since 2018 without informed consent or even uninformed consent to partners Verisk and LexisNexis. It used to be a news service. Now they're just following you. That data ended up being used against those drivers, offered to car insurance companies. They're good people. And used to raise the rates of those deemed to be bad drivers, a determination that wasn't always accurate. Quote, respecting our customers' privacy and earning their trust is deeply important to us, GM claimed in a statement this week. Although Smart Driver was created to promote safer driving behavior, we ended that program due to customer feedback, continued the statement. The proposed consent decree, that's the draft settlement between GM and the FTC to avoid a court battle, forbids the automaker from disclosing geolocation and driver behavior data to consumer reporting agencies for 5 years. See you then. The overall agreement, which lasts 20 years, also requires affirmative consent from drivers prior to collecting connected vehicle data, with exceptions for emergency services, letting folks obtain and delete their data, and ensuring that people can disable the collection of geolocation data and can opt out of the collection of geolocation and driver behavior data, with exceptions for emergency services. Quote, secretly collecting and sharing data driver location is a terrible practice that can cause real harm to unsuspecting consumers, said Director of Technology Policy at Consumer Reports and a former policy director of FTC's Office of Technology Research and Investigation. And by the way, he's a bad driver. More news of AI. Researchers at cyber defense contractor PeopleTech have found that facial recognition algorithms focus on specific areas of the face opens the door to subtler surveillance avoidance strategies. In a preprint paper, the chief scientist and data scientist of the outfit described their efforts to baffle facial recognition systems through the minimal application of makeup and manipulation of image files. The two recount various defenses that have been proposed against facial recognition systems, including something called CV dazzle, which creates asymmetries, using high contrast makeup, adversarial attack graphics that confuse algorithms, and juggalo makeup, which can be used to obscure jaw and cheek detection. And of course, there are masks. But the authors say these methods suffer from obviousness, to put it mildly. In contrast, this study, they say, demonstrates that effective disruption of facial recognition can be achieved through subtle darkening of high-density key point regions, your brow lines, your nose bridge, and jaw contours, without triggering the visibility issues inherent to overt disguises. They applied minimum makeup to fool HAAR cascade classifiers. They are used for object detection in machine learning, and hiding faces in image files by manipulating the alpha transparency layer in a way that keeps faces visible to human observers, but conceals them from specific reverse image search systems. Facial recognition, said one of the scientists, talking to the British Tech Journal and Register, represents a third rail issue, one that poses significant risks. It brings up all the best and worst parts of AI, he said, from bias to counting crowds to all the useful things that can be done with traffic movement. But overall, he argues, this kind of technology needs to be viewed with caution. It's incredibly useful technology, he says, for good, and incredibly dangerous. AI and facial recognition combined really is Pandora's box, so we have to be careful with it. Unquote. We could give it back to Pandora, I guess. But wait, there's more. Most businesses rushing to adopt AI are unprepared for the energy demands it'll place on their infrastructure, and few have a handle on the power consumption of AI systems or the implications for their data centers. This also from the British Tech Journal, The Register. Research commissioned by an AI chip company called SambaNova found that 72% of corporate leaders are aware AI models have huge energy requirements. Many are concerned about this, yet only 13% monitor the power consumption of the AI systems they have deployed. Power draw is driven most cases by reliance on power-hungry GPUs crammed into high-performance server systems to tackle model training. I say just slap a nice gown on them. Adding impetus to this problem and the need to solve it is the rise of so-called agentic AI models. These are developed to be capable of taking autonomous actions and solving multi-step problems. Their greater complexity will add to energy woes, according to SambaNova. Enough of the Samba. Now, ladies and gentlemen, news of bees. Researchers at Queen Mary University of London have discovered that the neonicotinoid pesticide clothianidin disrupts different parts of bumblebee bodies in strikingly different ways. Researchers' new study shows that the impacts of pesticides are far from uniform, affecting the brain, legs, and kidney-like tissues in different manners that undermine each tissue's essential functions, is all. By exposing bumblebees to a field-realistic dose of clothianidin, the scientists found dramatic differences in gene activity across body tissues. 82% of gene activity changes were tissue-specific. I've got one right here. Each tissue we examined was severely affected by the pesticides, explains Professor Yannick Wurm. Seeing impacts of pesticide exposure across the body helps to explain the multifaceted problem that exposed bees have, from impaired movement to reduced learning ability, I said, and compromised immunity. Nicotinoid pesticides such as clothianidin are widely used to protect crops from pests, yet past research has shown that even low doses can threaten the survival of beneficial insects. In this particular study, the researchers applied high-resolution molecular diagnostics to pinpoint the specific molecular pathways disrupted by pesticide exposure. For instance, while brain genes involved in ion transport were affected, the hind femur, which is crucial for movement, showed changes in muscle-specific genes, and the detoxification gene activities of malpighian tubules, which are bees equivalents of kidneys, decreased. Quote, the findings suggest traditional pesticide risk assessments, which often overlook tissue-specific damage, do not fully capture the sub-lethal impacts on pollinators, unquote, a co-author of the study. Not a bee, a co-author. The researchers emphasize these changes, which are akin to patterns seen in aging and cancer, indicate a profound threat to bee health, affecting every tissue in damaging ways. So let's get working on those artificial bees, shall we? And now, ladies and gentlemen, this story comes around every couple of years or so, and now it's back. The U.S. military spends $1.24 billion each year to address obesity in the ranks, as well as in the people. But Defense Department policies have been slow to adopt weight management treatment, including the therapies and medications such as, you know, the ones that are advertised on TV, to address a major readiness concern, according to new research uncovered by military.com. Obesity is the main reason potential recruits are disqualified from serving, preventing an estimated 52,000 from joining last year, 52,000 fatsos, and is a leading cause of separation from duty, with roughly 100,000 troops leaving between 2018 and 22 for weight-related reasons. That's according to the American Security Project think tank. During a forum to discuss the research and obesity's impact on military readiness, health experts said the Pentagon has access to new treatment options to help service members effectively manage their weight, but has been slow to address the issue. Quote, there are service-specific policies that are in place that are old and outdated and confusing. They talk about how you can't necessarily treat people with medications for anorexic purposes, said the director of Walter Reed's Internal Medicine Comprehensive Weight Management Program. A lot of people, he says, are fearful of the repercussions of treating people. Last year, the American Security Project, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank, noted that nearly 7 in 10 active duty personnel were either overweight or obese based on body mass index, a measure of weight versus height. Project analysts said this year, roughly 22% of the active duty force was medically considered obese, a body mass index of 30 or higher.
Well, when it comes down to truculence, the truck don't stop here. I'll cuss out the bad guys at the drop of a beer. I'll talk up America till dawn's early light. Too bad that I'm too fat to fight. I joined up with the army on some kind of dare, but traveling on my stomach, it made people stare. Couldn't fit in my bunk, my camo was too tight. Turns out I was too fat to fight. That's right, too fat to fight. And ain't it a shame? 'Cause war is really America's game. Got bellicose brains, but our varicose veins mirror all too fat to fight.
fight. We're all too fat to fight.
That's right. Now the burgers and the fries, the Cokes and ice cream. Well, I thought I was eating the American dream. But when my boots disappeared clean out of my sight, I could see I was too fat to fight. Now shooting, parachuting, clean out of a plane. It's not just a job, it's a terrible strain. The few and the proud will carry our might. The rest of us are too fat to fight. That's right. Too fat to fight, and it does seem a waste. But building up nations just ain't to our taste. Got bellicose brains, but our varicose veins mean we're all too fat to fight. Well, we picked a bad time to get off the pot. An army of one, maybe all that we got. The bad guys are fast, they're smart, and they're light. God made us too fat to fight. Now one of these days, my son will enlist. I'll be hiding my tears, by his mom he'll be kissed. He'll waddle on that drill field and be home by night. Like his dad, he'll be too fat to fight. Too fat to fight, and ain't it a shame, 'cause war is real. America's game. We got bellicose brains, but our varicose veins mean we're all too fat to fight. Yes, we're all too fat to fight.
From Continental Public Radio, CPR, live from the White House, the President of the United States until tomorrow.
My fellow Americans, and that's no joke, the other night I delivered my farewell address in this very office. Now I'm honored to deliver what my staff is allowing me to call my farewell plus from this very same office, this very office I just mentioned. I speak to you to say I deeply regret that my staff didn't allow me to speak to you this way last spring when I was considering running for re-election. That's what I wanted to speak to you about. No joke. Instead, my plans were kept private from you, the very people I wanted to speak to. If I could do it all over again, I think it's safe to say that I wouldn't, by which I mean I would, but in a different way.
A very different way.
After tonight, I won't be speaking to you this way, or maybe in any way. So I just want to reiterate that it has been the honor of my life to be allowed to speak to you in this way, or for that matter in any way. No joke. God bless this great country. God protect our troops. God bless you for listening to me speak in this way. God bless my wife and my staff for not letting me speak in this way before now. And after now, too. No joke.
This is CPR, public radio for the rest of us.
Now. I say now. News of the godly. Over two decades, Catholic dioceses, eparchies, those are dioceses in the Orthodox world, and men's religious community spend more than $5 billion on allegations of sexual abuse of minors. That's according to a new report released this week by the Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate at Georgetown University. Go Hoyas, between 2004 and 2023, what is a Hoya? Three-fourths of the $5.025 billion reported was paid to abuse victims. 17% went to pay attorneys' fees. 6% was in support for alleged abusers. And 2% went towards other costs. On the average, only 16% of the costs related to the allegations was borne by insurance companies. Rest was churches, dioceses, selling their assets. Jonathan Wiggins, the lead researcher on the report, said it represented the Catholic Church's superlative commitment to transparency. All right, then. The report, quote, is unprecedented by any non-governmental organization and is the largest effort of its kind, unquote, the report's authors. He said the report may have some overlap in cases with the groundbreaking 2004 research study on the nature and scope of sexual abuse in the church conducted by the John Jay Study of Criminal Justice, but that it has a different methodology. During the 20 years of the survey, respondents reported 16,276 credible allegations of sexual abuse of minors by priests, deacons, or religious brothers. Those allegations represent slightly less than two-thirds of total allegations that dioceses, eparchies, and men's religious communities reported receiving, though the surveys come from the 2000s, the majority of credible allegations were for abuse that began before 1980. That's when abuse was good. 92% of credible allegations were for abuse that began before 1989. In contrast, 542 credible allegations represented abuse that began after the year 2000, this report from the Religious News Service. The report defines credible allegations as bearing the semblance of truth and having been sufficiently substantiated to forward the allegations to the Vatican's dicastery for the doctrine of the faith. Don't you wish you had a dicastery for anything? Of the credible allegations, 4 in 5 victims were male, 1/5 were female. More than half were between the ages of 10 and 14. About a quarter of victims were between 15 and 17, and another 1 in 5 was age 9 or younger. News of the godly. And now,
we're so sorry.
Just a couple of good ones this week. Japanese Prime Minister Ishiba Shigeru has apologized to people affected by the now-defunct Eugenic Protection Law. He promised the government will pay compensation as required by new legislation. He this week met people who sued the state over forced sterilization under the law. The new legislation, which provides compensation to affected people and their spouses, took effect the same day. He expressed regret that the former plaintiffs were forced to undergo sterilization and abortion procedures because of their medical condition or disabilities. The Prime Minister also said the government has a grave responsibility as the entity that implemented the law and needs serious soul searching. Governments are good at that. And a large group of people greeted each other with morning chatter at the end of a Wrangell Peninsula on Saturday, where the Talkwaydl clan once resided. This is in Alaska. They were there to witness the U.S. Army apologize to the Wrangell Cooperative Association for bombarding the Tlingit village of Kachanaakwa in 1869. Best I could do. The tribe lost at least five people, a totem pole, and multiple houses. For the past 155 years, the tribe has been waiting for this apology. This was severed, one of several different stops on the walk to where the Tlingit clan once lived. The last was where a Tlingit man was hanged at Fort Wrangell. Before he turned himself in to stop the bombardment, he stopped at each clan's location to say goodbye. The group retraced his last steps on this walk. U.S. Army Major General Joseph Hilbert waited at the door to request permission to be on the tribe's territory. "Good afternoon, I'm Major General Joe Hilbert. I live and work on the land of the Tlingit people. I request permission to enter the land." And after accepting the request, the tribe sang a welcome song with a drum beat that filled the room. All of the clan leaders spoke in response to the Major General's request. "There really wasn't a handbook out on how this could happen," said one of the tribe leaders. "We've done plenty of feasts. We were preparing to raise poles. This was a new thing. This is a great thing, but it was still brand new territory." Some keynote speakers took turns speaking about how this event was historical, including U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski. Quote, "In order for us to move forward, the wrongs have to be addressed. They have to be acknowledged, and we need that apology for us to move forward and to heal." Unquote, the senator, who also said, "The solemnity the military presents is not casual. She hopes it's recognized." Later in the day, Major General Joseph Hilbert officially apologized to the clans. He assured everyone the apology was written by human beings with hearts, even though it might sound formal. Quote, "It is incredibly a heartfelt apology on behalf of the Department of the Army to acknowledge the 1869 bombardment of the Tlingit village by the United States Army," he said, "and to offer an apology to the Tlingit people on behalf of the United States Army." He acknowledged the bombardment resulted in death, suffering, and generational trauma on the Tlingit people. Quote, "I hope today represents not an end, but a beginning," Hilbert said, "a beginning of healing and a relationship between us going forward." Unquote. Not every clan accepted the apology. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Well, this week it is supposed to get really cold here in New Orleans. It's really cold the rest of the country, but it's nowhere colder in the land of crypto. It is a crypto winter. Maker's Place, a digital art platform specializing in non-fungible tokens, you remember those, is shutting down amid a sharp drop in the NFT market. Why? The company launched in 2018 announced its closure this week after 6 years of operations. Quote, "Ongoing market challenges and funding difficulties have made it difficult and made it impossible to sustain operations while fulfilling our mission," said the content manager, Brady Evan Walker, in the announcement. Maker Place's shutdown is another indication, according to Cointelegraph, which follows the crypto, quote, industry, unquote, another indication of an ongoing slump in the NFT industry, which plummeted to its worst performance levels since 2020 last year. Minting and new Maker Place accounts were disabled immediately. Users can still purchase NFTs on the platform till it shuts down completely. According to the announcement, Maker's Place will launch a transfer tool next month, allowing users to offload their NFTs from the platform until June. Launched in 2018, Maker's Place secured $50 million in funding from major industry companies. According to co-founder and CEO Danny Chu, Maker's Place aimed to play a central role in sparking the global conversation about NFTs, unquote. What a conversation starter. In the announcement, Maker's Place said that unused funds would be returned to investors, promised severances to to employees. After hitting all-time highs in terms of trading volumes in April 2022, the NFT hype gradually faded, according to accounts and records from DeFi Llama. The market downturn triggered numerous marketplaces to shut down operations in recent years. So, not so hot. The Mobi Trade DeFi Options Protocol, this is in cryptocurrency itself, suffered a $1 million loss, narrowly avoiding the loss of another nearly $1.5 million. The project team stated that a hacker had identified and exploited a vulnerability in the key management system that was supposed to protect a private key used by the project. Using the private key, they were able to perform contract upgrades that allowed them to drain about, well, $1.1 million in Bitcoin. Nearly 10,000 images of balls have plunged up to 90% in value after Tennis Australia seems to have walked away from its NFT program 3 years after it began selling the artworks to customers. That's according to The Guardian. Launched at the peak of hype around NFTs. Well, that wasn't hype. That was the Australian Open's art ball program allowed fanatics to buy 6,776 ball artworks sold as non-fungible tokens. They are linked to plots on the court at Melbourne Park where the Australian Open is played. In addition, in 2023, the Open had an additional 2,454 NFTs on offer. Customers left holding the NFT balls might have noticed a significant drop in the value of their asset. Tennis Australia marketed the program as similar to a frequent flyers program, offering a Discord channel for NFT holders, ground passes for finals weeks, and behind-the-scenes access, as well as passes to matches the following year if the portion of the court held in the NFT was linked to the match point plot on the court. Last year, the Australian Open appeared not to mint any new NFTs, but allowed existing owners to redeem ground passes to finals week. In 2025, there's no mention of the program from the Australian Open or any offer of redeeming passes, and sites for the Art Ball program remain dormant. The Discord server has been shut down. Tennis Australia had no comment. Strange. That. On January 15th of this year, the Idols NFT project suffered a significant security breach, resulting in the theft of approximately $324,000 in Ethereum. Sounds like a drug or a drink. Cough syrup. Ethereum. Let's try it. The attack targeted a vulnerability in the smart contract of the project, specifically a flaw in the before token transfer function, my favorite function. This vulnerability occurred when the sender and receiver addresses were the same, allowing the attacker to repeatedly claim awards, draining funds from the contract. Despite the project having undergone audits in previous years, the exploit took place in a contract that might not have been thoroughly reviewed for such flaws. As a precautionary measure, the Idols NFT team has advised users to refrain from interacting with any contracts related to the project until further notice, i.e., don't try to withdraw. The team is working to address the situation and ensure the security of the platform. They've also pledged to explore all available options to resolve the exploit and prevent further future incidents of this nature. I look forward to incidents of another nature. Within hours of launching the Sonium blockchain this week, Sony is already mired in controversy after freezing multiple meme coins. This is the Sony you've heard about. The move is costing users who invested in them thousands of dollars. Users in the Sonium Discord, a messaging app, started reporting they could no longer trade two recently created meme coins called Albo and Toro. Good names for coins, wouldn't you say? Sounds like currency to me. On Blockbuster's Sonium Explorer, a site used for checking blockchain data, both tokens are listed as forbidden and no longer show any transaction data. The problem appears to be the use of Sony's copyrighted material in creating the meme coins. Quote, measures were put in place to safeguard the rights of IP holders, said a spokesperson for Sony Block Solutions Labs, the firm behind the blockchain. The move is strange, observes DL News, because other blockchains have gone to great efforts to foster meme coins in the hope that one becomes viral hit and brings more attention to the blockchain. Sony, on the other hand, you'll find this odd, ladies and gentlemen, favors protecting its intellectual property. Quote, in the two cases where Sony's IP was used without authorization, swift action was necessary to uphold our mission of protecting creators' rights, according to a spokesperson. On other blockchains popular with meme coin traders, like Solana, users often appropriate copyrighted material in meme coins. That's the whole point of memes. Even if copyright holder objects to the use, it can be difficult for them to shut down the coin through legal means. Due to the decentralized nature of most blockchains and the anonymity of their users. But Sonium blocks this trend, or bucks it. Its centralization means its creators retain the ability to freeze any token they choose at any time. The Albo meme coin, which traded at a market value of $2.7 million before it was frozen, is named after a series of robotic dogs designed and manufactured by Sony. Toro references Toro Inoue, the unofficial cat mascot of Sony Interactive Entertainment. It traded as high as $1.1 million. Investors who bought the meme coins accused Sonium of rugging them in the blockchain's Discord. Rugging, or pulling the rug, is a crypto term describing a situation where the creator of a token or project sells their stash, usually in a single transaction, crashing the token's price for a quick profit at the expense of other investors. That sounds like a currency, doesn't it? The term is often used to refer to any action that crashes a token to zero. And finally, decentralized finance protocol Unilend Finance has reportedly been exploited on Ethereum, leading to a loss of roughly $197,000 in assets. This week, real-time web security startup 10Armor Alert reported that an attacker exploited Unilend's redeem process by manipulating a flaw in the share price calculation. This allowed the attacker to artificially inflate their collateral value and drain funds from the pool. Everybody out, they've drained the pool. The attacker, all this. As of publication, Unilend Finance had not addressed the exploit, and requests for additional insights from crypto.news remained unanswered. The DeFi sector, that's the decentralized finance sector, has remained a prime target for bad actors in recent years. I wish they'd leave show business out of this. According to blockchain forensic firm PeckShield, approximately 60% of all exploits and scams in 2024 targeted this sector. Ooh, it's a crypto winter. Finally, you all know that a decision is going to be made sometime today or tomorrow on the future of the Chinese-owned app TikTok. It has been controversial, mainly because of its Chinese ownership, but also because it sells user data for nefarious purposes, perhaps, to the Chinese government.
Very far away in a foreign land, lives the yellow woman in the yellow man. understand. You know we understand that.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. You know, I'd feel better if the TikTok data was sold to American companies to spy on us, because they'll just sell us more ads. And those are good, aren't they? This program returns next week at the same time over these same radio stations or on your audio device of choice. Hope to join with you then. The email address for this program, your chance to get Cars I Talk t-shirts, and the playlist of the music you hear heard here or hear here, all at harryshearer.com. I'm on Blue Sky at Harry Shearer and on X at the Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from the Crescent City.